from St. Louis Public Radio. This is St. Louis on the Air.
He was searching his whole life to see if he could find some answer that he could understand that would help to explain why something like this would have occurred.
Did he ever find that answer then, one that was satisfactory to him?
No, I don't think he ever did. Mm-hmm. I don't think he ever did. And this is a man who was as well read and studied and versed in everything from literature to science and history as anybody, you know, who's ever read a book.
I'm Sarah Fenske. Gustav Schoenfeld titled his memoir Absence of Closure. It tells the story of his boyhood on the border of Czechoslovakia and Hungary in the 1930s and 40s, and his deportation to Auschwitz. As a boy, Gustav survived both Auschwitz and Dachau, and then a third camp, before being liberated and emigrating to the U.S. He settled in East St. Louis. He became a physician and the head of the Department of Medicine at the Washington University School of Medicine. A few years ago, Gustav's son turned that memoir into a rock opera. It's called Iron and Coal, and it grapples with Jeremy Schoenfeld's memories of his father and his attempts to create a life out of the ashes of the Holocaust. Jeremy Schoenfeld describes it as Bernstein's Mass meets Pink Floyd's The Wall.
Was I too afraid that you wouldn't understand, that you wouldn't take my hand, and that you never knew me all along? 'Cause my dues have all been paid.
And that is the Kaddish from the opening scene of Iron and Coal. The rock opera streams this Thursday night via Southern Illinois University Edwardsville. And joining us today to tell us all about it is composer Jeremy Schoenfeld. Jeremy, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Jeremy, you've said that as a child you lived in the shadows of the Holocaust. What did it feel like growing up within those shadows?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, we were a Jewish family in St. Louis, but even amongst other Jewish families, we felt kind of like we had a unique place as, you know, for me as being a survivor's child and also being a lot younger than a lot of other survivors' children, because my father was so young when he was in the camps. So I think I was very aware that while I fit in, I was a St. Louis kid, I loved the Cardinals, I played baseball and did all my music stuff. I was also very keenly aware that it was a unique situation. We had a very unique family with a lot of very strong Eastern European accents.
So your father was 10 when he was first sent to the camps. Growing up, was he open to talking about those horrible experiences with you?
He was, more so than my grandfather and my grandmother, who had also survived, his parents. Mm-hmm. A lot of the conversations that we had, gearing to the age of the child. So there were certain things that I got in bits and pieces as I got older. But there are a lot of things, I think it's part of the, again, being the child of a survivor. There are things that you would catch and then maybe forget, or forget details, or forget the timeline. And it really wasn't until much later that I was able to really piece together the story from front to back and in a much more specific way.
I imagine his memoir played a big role in that. What sparked him to write a memoir?
Well, I think my father, his whole life, you know, he was searching. I won't say that he was tortured. My father, one of the quotes, and we use actually his voice in the quote that I recorded, of where he said that, you know, apart from one bad year, he's had a wonderful life.
Wow.
And so I think that he really lived that. I don't think that was just, you know, positive kind of affirmation. But I think that he was, that being said, he was searching his whole life to see if he could find some answer that he could understand that would help to explain why something like this would have occurred, which is, of course, why he named the memoir Absence of Closure.
Did he find that answer then, one that was satisfactory to him?
No, I don't think he ever did. Hmm. I don't think he ever did. And this is a man who was as well read and studied and versed in everything from literature to science and history as anybody, you know, who's ever read a book. So I think there was, but I think so there were, it was twofold. The reason for creating was, first of all, to put it down, to have that document for his family. Really, you know, it wasn't about money. It wasn't about trying to reach out to, you know, to the world so much as to make sure that his story was there for his family and for those people who might be interested in hearing about it. And I think for him also, there was a cathartic experience trying to write these things down, finding out, you know, where he was actually more emotionally impacted as he was creating this thing. And I think that was something, you know, from a clinical scientific type of mind, I think finding out how emotional these things still were, I think was something that he might have been prepared for, but maybe not as prepared for as he had first thought.
Hmm. And what about for you? Were there things you learned about your father for the first time after reading this memoir?
That's an interesting question. I found that, well, first of all, I think that as we were talking about the emotional impact, I found out just how much he had really tried to understand and wrap his head around this, and how it was a lifelong pursuit.
Hmm.
I don't think I had quite really given that kind of credit to the you know, to his emotional journey on that in that way. So you know, so the facts I knew, the stories I knew, but really it was more about the way that they had sort of transformed him psychologically, and that was that for me. That's sort of an emotional attacking point for what I do musically. After many thoughts and attempts at trying to figure out how I wanted to say, that ended up being my entry point, the psychological.
Hmm. Well, that's actually a great reminder. Let's play another excerpt from Iron and Coal. This song is called Epilogue, Story of Love.
Never missed a chance to explore all the beauty and joy life's provided me. It doesn't mean the past been ignored. It's just that chapter is placed now where it ought to be. And someday when you understand the journey I took, and may the shadows that followed me disappear, and may the closer you look remind you to cherish those so dear. Fight through the struggle for glory, for the story.
That is the song Epilogue, Story of Love. It's from the rock opera Iron and Coal. My guest today is the composer, Jeremy Schoenfeld, and this rock opera is something that Southern Illinois University Edwardsville is streaming on Thursday. We have a link on our website where you can join in for that experience. Jeremy, this song is so touching. It sounds like that's you're singing in your father's voice as he's talking to you. Is that right?
That is correct. Thank you. Yeah, it was... It was actually the last song that I wrote for the album itself, for the original concept album. And I wrote that song, a lot of it where the album was recorded in Vienna. I think I had a certain perspective once I had gotten through much of the journey and much of the album. And I felt that there was one piece that was missing, which was the first piece that you played an excerpt from at the beginning, The Mourner's Kaddish, is really a son talking to his father through time. And I felt that the bookend epilogue, Story of Love, was in its own way a reply of a father wherever he is speaking to his son. Mm. And it's really, of course, imagined through the son that his father's, you know, this is what his father might say. So,
Sort of the imagined thing that your father might leave you with. Is this something where he knew you were working on this? Did he ever get to a point of getting to hear this song?
Yeah, he, the tragic part of this for me was that when I recorded the album, which was actually, the original album was recorded in 2011 in Vienna, my father passed away the day the album itself was mastered. The very day, May 21st of 2011, Dad knew what I was doing, and we had discussed, as we did when he was writing his memoirs, and he would send pages to me and to my siblings, Josh and Julia, to look at and discuss. He knew that I was attempting to create something, and that I was attempting to create this sort of, as I told him, this parallel journey of a father who survives the war, dealing with sort of the emotional roller coaster of surviving, and then you have until the birth of his son, I should say, and then you have a son who grows up underneath the shadows of Auschwitz, who is now trying to come out from underneath that shadow once his father has passed away. Hmm. So, and I play the song, the actual Kaddish, where the son is really speaking to his father who has passed away. I played that for my father. So, he knew, I knew that things were, he was getting sicker. And, but I just, I didn't anticipate that he would actually have, not get to hear the finished product.
And what was that like getting to play that Kaddish for him? I understand the Kaddish, this is a mourning ritual within the Jewish community. And here you were playing it when he was still alive.
Yeah, for very much my alive father. It was a very surreal, difficult. I was actually as nervous just playing that for my father as I would have been performing in front of a couple thousand people as we mm-hmm. did at the Strathmore when we did the first premiere. It was very strange, and but I knew it needed to happen. I knew he needed to know. I almost felt like I wanted some blessing from him that whether he got to hear the completed album and show or not, that he understood and was was supportive of the work that I was trying to create.
And did he give you that blessing?
He did. Yeah, he did.
Was it a moving experience for him to hear this, or was this something that was difficult in some ways?
That's tough. I think it was a moving experience. He didn't outwardly, mm-hmm. become incredibly emotional, but I think it was more of a, just there was a sort of a deep understanding between the two of us, that a mutual respect, which mm. I think any, son and father, I felt like that at that moment I had his, his respect for what I was attempting to do, which, this isn't always the kind of subject matter that people think is ripe for musicalization. Mm-hmm. So, so I think that he respected that for me, that diving into the deep end of the pool was really kind of where my where my passion is when it comes to creating stories and emotionally compelling pieces.
Hmm. So this began with a concept album, and you released it that way, but it has had such an amazing afterlife after this original conception. How did you go from this is an album to this is a rock opera, and there's actually also a visual element? This becomes a performance.
Yeah. It's been a journey. That's for sure. It has a, so first when I finished the album, it was obviously very difficult because the idea of trying to shill and mourn simultaneously is, is a very difficult thing.
That's some tough timing.
It was very tough timing. And of course, I'd also created this overseas. So, you know, while we had a lot of buzz over there, and we had worked with, you know, many, many people, many musicians and publicists and all the stuff that we had over there, it was virtually unknown, the project that I was doing here in the States. Mm-hmm. So the first, you know, at first I had, to answer your question about the actual creation, I knew that what I had created needed to be performed, for me at least, as a concept album from like a front to back experience. So mm-hmm. when I was creating it, once I had created it, I began to think of ways in which I could express that. And one of the first things that occurred to me was that my friend and fellow St. Louisan Tom Seltzer, who created the original artwork for the album, I just thought it was such an evocative, emotional thing that I asked, do you think you could create some animation based on your works? And he took a stab at it, and I got together with another friend, a multimedia specialist named Paul Virschbau in Manhattan, and we started basically taking things like, I took all of the Super 8 films that had been sitting in canisters in the attic in our house, and a ton of old photographs, and I put all that into some digital form so that we could cut it up and put it into these songs and with the animation. And I had a friend, Natalie Lamont, who choreographed some amazing modern and Broadway dancers, and we filmed that. Hmm. I took the songs and I started making almost like music videos for them, really just sort of led by emotion. And we were commissioned at first to do this at a synagogue in Brooklyn as a performance. And when that fell through, you know, I had this work. Mm-hmm. And I had all this stuff. So, you know, cut to a couple years later, a friend of ours, a director who had been following this the entire time, Kevin Newberry, who ended up directing the piece, said, you know what, let's jump into this and make it happen. And we ended up performing it in Brooklyn at the National Sawdust, which is a wonderful smaller venue. And that's when Beth Morrison, producer, stepped in to take a look. And my friend Joy Brown, who brought us to the Strathmore, also was in attendance. And, so we kind of picked it up piece by piece. And from there led to the workshop where we put the pieces together. We put I had wanted to put my father's memoirs in there. So we sat there with the book, you know, earmarked many, many pages of different ideas of quotes. And we stuck them all on a wall. And then as we kind of went through the songs, we figured out what the flow was, what pieces needed to be there, what things we wanted to create. Mm-hmm. And the actual multimedia production that that you see is basically, it's the result of that workshop. It's, you know, I should say that the difference between a concept album and the production is that there are songs that are from the original album that are not in the show. Mm-hmm. But and also vice versa, there are songs that I created specifically for the stage piece that are not on the concept album. So, the viewing that people will have is the first, literally the world premiere performance of all of those efforts. So that's the actual first performance, warts and all.
And in our final minutes here, I want to bring it back to this music because it's just so moving. Let's play a bit of another song from Iron and Coal, and this is called Stop.
There's something wrong inside my head. There's something the matter. Wouldn't you rather be happier instead of always running around and round in circles? Everything you said, or would you rather be dead? 6 million down, one more. 6 million down, one more. I set the whole damn thing on fire. I set the whole damn thing go round and round and round and round and round. I go, I set the whole damn thing on fire.
And that is Stop from Iron and Coal, the rock opera from composer Jeremy Schoenfeld. Jeremy, this whole project is an attempt to come to terms with almost the unthinkable, this terrible story that your father managed to survive and find this life after. In the process of writing this, were you able to come to terms with this in a way you hadn't before?
Yeah, it was really good question. It was a very cathartic experience for me as well. The idea that I was, I had a great relationship with my father, and you know, I don't think we left anything on the table mm-hmm. when he did pass away. But for me to be able to have this sort of conversation through time, that was, you know, again, an invented conversation. But it was important for me to feel like I could, you know, emotionally sort of connect and emotionally say these things, the doubts, you know, the sort of time honored, did I ever make you proud? Those kinds of questions, many questions and many things emotionally that I was able to put down in music. But then, the actual performance that we created at the Strathmore, where we had some 230 people, you know, with choruses and orchestras and this huge multimedia in this incredibly gorgeous 2,000 seat auditorium in Bethesda, Maryland. It was unbelievably gratifying just to be able to sit there and look around and think that that something that I sat at the piano and toiled over could end up being something so so huge and impactful.
Well, composer Jeremy Schoenfeld, we want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing about this work.
Thank you very much for having me.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here. Spend the rest of your days caught in the web of this haze. You can work it out. Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you. St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis. Well, there is nothing-